Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. As Immigrants List reported this week, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released a recent economic and budget forecast that explains that our economy is on an upward trajectory and that immigration is a major reason. The CBO explained that immigration grows the labor force. In part because of immigration, the CBO writes, quote, from 2023 to 2034, GDP will be greater by about $10 trillion and revenues will be greater by about $1 trillion than they would have been otherwise, end quote. The Federal Reserve also noted that the lack of immigrants in 2021 due to pandemic closures at the border led to, quote, labor shortages and supply chain problems, end quote. So there's that. A fact highlighted quite starkly in the tragic event at that Baltimore bridge a couple of weeks ago that resulted in the deaths of migrant workers. It's another short week of cases, but they're interesting. So of course I did them. Why wouldn't I? Starting off with Abdullahad v. Garland, published by the Sixth Circuit on April 11th, 2024. This case is about motions to reopen, changed country conditions, Convention Against Torture Protection, and Iraq. Mr. Abdullahad is from Iraq, and he's a Chaldean Christian. He fled with his family in the 1990s and received lawful permanent resident status in the United States in 2000. But in 2003, he was arrested in Aruba for attempting to transport 500 grams of cocaine. Seems like he made it out of Aruba, came back to the United States, and he was convicted in Aruba in absentia. Based on that foreign in absentia conviction, DHS tried to remove him. He then did not appear for his immigration court hearing in 2006, and he was ordered removed in absentia. But because Iraq was literally the worst place on earth in 2006, he was not removed there, and he has been reporting to ICE on orders of supervision ever since. Until it appears the Trump administration tried to physically remove him in 2017, wherein Mr. Abdullah had filed an emergency motion to reopen based on changed country conditions in Iraq since 2006 that materially affected his eligibility for relief and protection, he argued. An immigration judge granted that motion. Seems like everyone agrees that Mr. Abdullahad's cocaine conviction bars him from everything but deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture, but the IJ believed that Mr. Abdullahad had established a prima facie case for cat protection based on changed country conditions. But then, after a two-day hearing, lots of evidence, and an expert witness, the IJ denied cat deferral on the merits. It appears that a lot of the case back then was based on a fear of ISIS, but by the time of the hearing in 2018, the IJ didn't see a case, at least not enough. The BIA affirmed. Mr. Abdullah had filed another motion to reopen with the BIA while it was pending with the BIA, and the BIA denied it. The Sixth Circuit then denied petitions for review of both the merits and the denial of the motion to reopen. He was not removed, though, and Mr. Abdulahad filed a third motion to reopen in January 2021. The BIA denied it. Oyl asked for a remand on that petition for review. It was remanded. Mr. Abdulahad then filed another motion to reopen. The BIA then denied that as well. I guess by this time there were two pending motions to reopen with the BIA filed at different times. And now we're back at the Sixth Circuit on the denial or the denials of those latter motions to reopen. Okay. Confusing procedural history concluded. Don't sleep on the procedural history in your briefs though, guys. Sometimes it can tell quite the story. And quite frankly, in part because of this procedural history, the Sixth Circuit is sending it back. And that is in part because, in everything it does, the BIA must, quote, analyze and explain the basis on which it decides against the petitioner, meaning it must actually consider the evidence and arguments put forth by the petitioner, end quote. The BIA didn't do so here sufficiently, said the Sixth Circuit. First, the INA permits as many changed country condition motions to reopen as a non-citizen in the United States wants to file, provided, of course, that conditions have changed materially. And when a non-citizen files such a motion, well, the BIA, or IJ as relevant, must consider it, even if the judge has considered similar arguments and evidence before. And that's really where the BIA first messed up here, said the Sixth Circuit. In its motion to reopen denial before the Sixth Circuit, the BIA, quote, repeatedly and explicitly compared evidence that Mr. Abdulahad submitted with his most recent motion to reopen to evidence submitted with his prior motions to reopen, end quote. But that's not the proper analysis for a changed country condition motion to reopen. No matter how many such motions are filed, the proper analysis requires comparison of the new evidence with conditions at the time of the merits hearing. And that is the case even when, as the Sixth Circuit recognized here in a footnote, motions to reopen are filed only 10 months apart. The first focus is always on the merits hearing conditions. Seems like the BIA got a bit confused with this procedural history as well. All of that means that the BIA, quote, incorrectly disregarded most of Mr. Abdulahad's evidence as cumulative or not new, end quote. To the extent the BIA can do that is, deny a changed country condition motion to reopen by finding evidence cumulative, it appears it must be only as compared to the evidence submitted at the merits hearing, not to evidence submitted in previous motions to reopen. And that's an important thing for us practitioners to remember. It's all the more problematic here because the Sixth Circuit believes that the evidence that was largely disregarded appears material. Even though Chaldean Christians have had issues in Iraq for a while, including in 2006 and 2018, when hearings were held in this case, quote, changed country conditions are material when the country becomes more hostile towards a petitioner or their group, end quote. A material escalation in bad conditions will cut it for reopening. Here, the Sixth Circuit doesn't quite understand the BIA's reasoning on this, and so is sending it back. Take note, everyone. A statement such as one reasoning that, quote, Christians have long faced discrimination in Iraq, end quote, to deny a changed country condition motion to reopen, without more, is error. Bad things can get worse and result in reopening. As if all this were not good enough for non-citizens in the Sixth Circuit, the court then noted the pretty much universal circuit agreement that IJs and the BIA must consider CAT claims in the aggregate. And so the Sixth Circuit held, apparently for the first time in a precedential decision, that, quote, if a petitioner invokes more than one independent source of or reason for the risk of torture, the BIA must consider the petitioner's risk of torture in the aggregate, end quote. What does that mean? Well, it means that, quote, under the aggregate rule, a petitioner alleging probable torture from independent sources need not demonstrate that the probability of torture by one of the entities or for one of the reasons taken alone exceeds 50%. Instead, the question is whether the cumulative probability of torture by all of the entities or for all reasons exceeds 50%, end quote. That's the rule in most, if not all, circuits, and now it is officially the rule in the Sixth Circuit. Important stuff. Big win. By the way, the Sixth Circuit believes that the BIA has also adopted this requirement in matter of JRGP from 2018. To the court, the BIA expressly failed to conduct that analysis here, and so the BIA erred. Mr. Abdullahad's claim wasn't just based on his being a Chaldean Christian, as the BIA focused on in its denial. Moving on, because there's more. Remember this when challenging a BIA decision on petition for review because, well, I've definitely seen it before. Quote, the BIA abuses its discretion if it explicitly considers some, but not all, of the critical bases of a petitioner's claim. End quote. Specifically to the Sixth Circuit, the BIA neglected to consider the individualized risk of torture Mr. Abdullahad had reason to fear due to the, quote, rising tensions between the United States and Iran, and Mr. Abdullahad's perceived danger to Iraqi society, end quote, in addition, of course, to his status as a Chaldean Christian. Finally, the BIA's deficiencies were not harmless. Rather, quote, the BIA's errors impacted every aspect of its decision, end quote. The Sixth Circuit goes on to explain that things do seem worse for people like Mr. Abdullahad in Iraq. Apparently, Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, or PMFs, have been committing human rights abuses and targeting Chaldean Christians and other minorities, and become more hostile to U.S. personnel and those perceived to support them, as Iraq gravitates closer to Iran politically. Nor has the Iraqi government really done much to investigate or stop this. All said by the Sixth Circuit, attorneys with Iraqi clients. Judge Gibbons sees things differently and dissented. But I can do no more. Long, exceptionally dense decision, with lots of arguments, and lots of arguing with the dissent, in footnote. Doesn't matter for Mr. Abdullahad, of course, though. Congratulations, Nadia Anguiano of the University of Minnesota, and law student Jeremy Ruppert for petitioner, along with friend of the podcast Russell Abrutin, who joined them on brief. Always a good person to try to rope in on your writing. And here's a thought that came to me. Notice what's not said or argued in this case. There is no discussion of whether Mr. Abdullahad abandoned his right to cat protection when he didn't show up for that initial merits hearing in 2006. It seems that everybody assumed that provided conditions had materially changed, as an IJ found they did, Mr. Abdullahad could reopen his case even though he didn't show up in 2006. And without Mr. Abdullahad having to satisfy an in absentia specific motion to reopen basis, such as a lack of notice. Change country conditions trump all, to use some profanity on the podcast. And that is Abdullahad v. Garland. Next, we're going to do Chidati et al. V. Blinken et al., published by the Fifth Circuit on April 9th, 2024. And I'm not going to go into it too deep, I just kind of want to note it for the podcast page, where I list all decisions ever discussed on the podcast with bulleted notes. Have you checked it out? In this case, the Fifth Circuit rejected an argument that's now been rejected two or three times in other circuits. That is, the Fifth Circuit rejected an argument that certain Indian nationals who have been waiting forever for their employment-based visa petitions to become current, and who were current for the shortest of periods in 2023 before the date retrogressed, can sue USCIS under the Administrative Procedures Act for the chaos. The plaintiffs cannot sue USCIS. They lack jurisdiction. Check out the latest iteration of this in more detail from episode 202, The Gula v. Jadot, published by the Eighth Circuit on March 5th, 2024. It's pretty much the same reasoning. Very unfortunately for litigants beyond this specific type of lawsuit, and like that Eighth Circuit decision, the Fifth Circuit reads INA section 242A2Bii of stripping federal courts of jurisdiction, because things like this, retrogression, adjustment of status, all of it, are just so dang discretionary. Quote, retrogression hold policies are effectuated through discrete acts by Department of State and USCIS, informed by these regulations. For instance, Department of State amends the visa bulletin to establish a new final action date, and USCIS decides to delay adjudicating the applications, or in other words, set the status of an application to pending, end quote. All of that is discretionary, and to the Fifth Circuit, Section 242A2Bii strips litigants of challenging pretty much all discretionary actions when made by USCIS. That's a bit more expansive than what the Fifth Circuit held, but that is where the case law seems to be going. As discussed last week, even though Patel was about Section 242A2B single eye, the courts are reading Patel broadly as indicative of the Supreme Court's view that Congress intended Section 242A2B generally to be quite expansive and strip federal courts of jurisdiction over lots of things. And Section 242A2B double I is becoming that vehicle. The jurisdictional noose is tightening. Here it means that these Indian plaintiffs cannot bring their lawsuit. I wonder how many other circuits this case was filed in. I feel like I'll be doing it on the podcast a few more times, hopefully in a more non-citizen-friendly tone. And that is Chijati et al., v. Blinken et al. This podcast is sponsored by Driftwood Capital. Driftwood Capital boasts a 30-plus year track record, transacting on more than $3 billion in hospitality assets. Since 2015, Driftwood Capital has successfully implemented the EB-5 program into their development deals, helping more than 160 families find a secure path to residency through their projects. Driftwood Capital is a vertically integrated commercial real estate firm specializing in hospitality with dedicated acquisitions, development, lending, and management divisions. Their goal is to create long-term partnerships with its network of more than 1,200 active investors from the United States and abroad while targeting attractive returns. Driftwood's unique approach involves managing all aspects in-house, from developing renowned hotel brands such as Marriott, Hilton, and Hyatt, to managing their portfolio of more than 80 hotels in the United States. If you want to learn more about Driftwood Capital, check out the show notes. And of course, let them know who sent you. We all know the immense dedication it takes to be an immigration lawyer. You fight tirelessly for your clients, their families, and their futures. But let's face it, the administrative side of running a practice can feel overwhelming. Mountains of paperwork, endless calls, juggling deadlines, it can easily steal your focus and leave you feeling burnt out. But what if there was a way to simplify all of it? I want to tell you about Filevine, a legal case management platform specifically designed by lawyers for lawyers. Filevine keeps all case information centralized in one place. Plus, Filevine's immigration-specific tool, Immigration AI, uses the most advanced AI-powered technology to extract vital information from passports, birth certificates, and other essential documents, and automates USCIS form filling through smart questionnaires available in up to 170 languages. Pretty impressive. Filevine and Immigration AI can give you back precious time and energy, allowing you to focus on what matters most, your clients and their cases. So if you're ready to reclaim your time and rediscover the joy of practicing immigration law, head on over to immigration.ai/immigration review. Links in the show notes. Are you tired of answering your own phones or of wasting your valuable time on unqualified consultations? Staffy Live is the only 24/7 live receptionist and intake service specialized on immigration law. Staffy Live specialists are highly empathetic, bilingual individuals who know how to deal with adversity, have a background in client care, and are trained to qualify callers by asking the right questions. Staffy Live goes one step ahead in only scheduling qualified consultations on your calendar and then doing follow-ups when needed. Staffy Live is giving a 15-day free trial for any law firm interested with no strings attached. To apply, visit www.getstaffy.com. That's GETSTAFI.com and click on Get Started. Make sure to put in the code FREE. Links, of course, in the show notes. Which brings us to our final case. Farhain v. United States, published by the Second Circuit on August 11th, 2023. Just like 2 weeks ago, this is another decision that I've been saving for a short week. And as this is our last case, well, we have a short week. This is a criminal case about ineffective assistance of counsel and immigration. It's happening in the denaturalization context. As many listeners know, ineffective assistance of counsel in immigration is an issue near and dear to my heart and which I believe is in need of reform, particularly in light of the unfortunate suicide of one of our colleagues a few months ago. As I've also mentioned before, Rekha Sharma Crawford has a petition that asks the BIA or Attorney General to vacate or amend its nearly as old as your host, Matter of Lozada decision, that in effect requires that we immigration attorneys file bar complaints against one another to get relief for our clients when ineffective assistance of counsel, or things that look like ineffective assistance of counsel, have been committed. So let's do this case and see what the Second Circuit has to say. Mr. Farhane is a naturalized U.S. citizen born in Morocco. In 2006, and as a U.S. citizen, he pled guilty to conspiring to commit money laundering. But in his plea allocation, quote, he stated that in 2001, he conspired to transfer money to Mujahideen in Afghanistan and Chechnya, end quote. And that was before he naturalized. He received 13 years imprisonment. Upon his release in the midst of the Trump administration and its denaturalization task force, the U.S. government filed a complaint against him under USC Section 1451A, seeking to denaturalize Mr. Farhane for his illegally procuring his naturalization by concealment of a material fact or willful misrepresentation. Mr. Farhane, of course, did not tell USCIS that he was funding Islamic fundamentalist fighters in Chechnya or Afghanistan when he applied to naturalize or before his oath ceremony. If nothing else to the Second Circuit, that would have been responsive to the somewhat absurd gotcha question on the N-400 of whether the naturalization applicant has ever committed a crime that they were not arrested for. But also, don't money launder to Mujahideen. Anyway, it looked like Mr. Farhane was in big trouble in his denaturalization case, and he was likely going to lose. He therefore filed a habeas petition in Southern District of New York Federal Court to vacate his conviction based on a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel in the criminal proceedings in 2006. He claimed that, quote, his lawyer had not warned him of the risk of denaturalization and deportation before he pled guilty, end quote. The federal court denied the motion. The Second Circuit affirmed that by split decision. As I mentioned, this is criminal court ineffective assistance of counsel, not immigration court. That means that the issue is not in any way governed by Matter of Lozada and the whole bar complaint framework, but is instead governed by the Supreme Court's well-known Strickland v. Washington standard, applicable pretty much in every other context except immigration. Under that case, an ineffective assistance of counsel claim requires that a, quote, defendant establish both his trial court's deficient performance and the defendant's resulting prejudice, end quote. There is no requirement that in criminal court, defense attorneys file a bar complaint against one another. And unlike in immigration court, the right to competent counsel in criminal court is a Sixth Amendment right, not a Fifth Amendment due process right. But here's the thing, said the Second Circuit majority. Quote, because civil denaturalization is a collateral and not direct consequence of a conviction, the Sixth Amendment does not require attorneys to warn of that risk, end quote. How on earth does that square with the Supreme Court's Padilla v. Kentucky decision, which does indeed require criminal counsel to inform non-citizens of the potential removal risks, which of course is also collateral and civil? I'm sure we're about to find out. Indeed, it appears that that is exactly the point that the dissent makes. In Padilla, after all, quote, the Supreme Court held that the Sixth Amendment requires counsel to inform their client whether the plea carries a risk of deportation, end quote. But apparently in the Second Circuit and other circuits, long before Padilla, it was the case that, quote, a defendant can only establish an ineffective assistance claim as to a collateral consequence if his attorney affirmatively misadvises him, end quote. The Second Circuit majority believes that this rule survives Padilla. That is, that for collateral consequences, a failure to advise is not sufficient. You have to have affirmative misadvice. The Second Circuit explains that criminal counsel can't possibly know or advise about all the collateral consequences that follow a criminal guilty plea. There must be some limiting principle for ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The collateral consequence versus direct consequence dichotomy makes sense to the majority. Failure to advise about a direct consequence would be ineffective assistance of counsel, but collateral consequences, they're different. But again, what about Padilla? That was about collateral consequences, right? Removal. Well, to the majority, Padilla left the collateral versus direct consequence framework in place. It just believed that advising about removal wasn't quite so collateral, as removal is a, quote, particularly severe, end quote, consequence, and is, quote, near automatic, end quote, if a non-citizen obtains a certain type of criminal conviction. Do tell, Second Circuit, do tell. I seem to recall a particularly interesting decision from the Second Circuit about how the abuse of a corpse is not a CIMT last summer. But I digress. Really sympathetic facts in that case, though. I am not in any way challenging that decision from last summer. More important legally, though, the Second Circuit quotes the Supreme Court from 2 years after Padilla and Chavez as recognizing that, quote, Padilla did not eschew the direct collateral divide across the board, and that deportation is the most difficult penalty to classify as either a collateral or direct consequence, end quote. All this legalese aside, that really makes the question this. What is denaturalization more like? A non-covered collateral consequence, or a covered pseudo-collateral consequence like removal from the United States? It's the non-covered type, said the majority. Again, quote, the Padilla court emphasized two factors when concluding that the distinction did not apply to deportation. Deportation's severity and its automatic character, end quote. The Second Circuit explained that, yes, denaturalization is sufficiently severe, but that alone is not enough. To the court, denaturalization for a conviction is not certain enough. This despite all the judges on the case seemingly acknowledging that Mr. Fairhain is almost surely going to get denaturalized for this, and removal proceedings and his removal is very likely afterwards. But for denaturalization itself, quote, it depends not on the fact of conviction, but on the individual's actions before and at the time of naturalization. It can occur with or without a criminal conviction, end quote. All true, to be fair. And this is happening here to Mr. Fairhain, based on acts that he admitted later to having committed before he naturalized. Not necessarily because of the conviction per se. And this is just me, but also as the Second Circuit kind of notes later, denaturalization cases weren't filed that much before the former administration, and quite frankly, even during it, notwithstanding its denaturalization task force. Without the sufficient certainty of denaturalization, the Second Circuit held that an ineffective assistance of counsel claim can't lie based simply on a failure to warn of a possible denats. One final argument of interest was shot down, and I'm going to just quote it in full because, to me, it's interesting. Quote, Mr. Fairhain and the dissent both suggest that it would be incongruous to hold that the Sixth Amendment does not apply to warnings about denaturalization because it would mean that naturalized citizens who are not entitled to a warning about a plea that could lead to deportation down the road are less protected than non-citizens who must be warned if their plea exposes them to deportation. But this compares apples to oranges. Congress chose to treat the civil denaturalization of citizens differently from the removal of non-citizens by not tying denaturalization to a criminal conviction. It is unsurprising that a competent counsel's obligations would differ under these different statutory schemes. End quote. Interesting stuff. Return to that in a sec. Judge Carney in dissent notes that many state Supreme Courts and circuits have held or might be inclined to hold that the collateral versus direct consequence dichotomy to Strickland-based ineffective assistance of counsel claims is on shaky ground after Padilla. Judge Carney concludes by stating that Mr. Fairhain's, quote, guilty plea makes it virtually inevitable that he will lose his U.S. citizenship and be removed from this country, banished from his home of nearly 30 years. His children, too, face the loss of their own citizenship. His trial counsel's failure to advise him that his plea agreement risked triggering these consequences constituted objectively unreasonable performance under prevailing professional norms in 2006, as it would now. End quote. Anyway, the majority opinion makes it such that Mr. Fairhain's ineffective assistance of counsel claim in criminal court fails. And it's all got me thinking. This decision explains that when and how Strickland applies is currently the subject of serious debate amongst the circuits and state Supreme Courts. Specifically, what type of non-criminal collateral consequences are covered by Strickland such that if a defense counsel fails to warn their client about them, an ineffective assistance of counsel claim lies? As the majority explains, Padilla shook up lots of prior precedent and made clear that at least one pseudo-collateral consequence must be warned of. Removal. Restated, and even as the Second Circuit majority denying relief explains it, Padilla and then Chavez acknowledge that generally, Strickland does not require defense counsel to warn defendants of any collateral consequences except the collateral consequence of civil removal, because that consequence is so serious and so automatic that removal proceedings are the exception. Criminal defense counsel must warn of this collateral consequence or risk ineffective assistance of counsel. So if removal proceedings are such a big deal to the federal courts that it is an exception and requires a duty to warn, why are they the only form of ineffective assistance of counsel that in removal proceedings requires a bar complaint under matter of Lozada and are not covered by Strickland? Seems like there's a strong Supreme Court-based argument that ineffective assistance of counsel claims in removal proceedings should be governed by Strickland. After all, if removal proceedings are the collateral exception governed by Strickland in criminal proceedings, ineffective assistance of counsel claims in immigration court should probably be governed by Strickland, too. And that is Farhane v. United States. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review, or send us a tweet at imreview. That's I-M-M review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.